to the view of the church, the Mass is based on the historical events in Jesus' life. The scourging, crowning with thorns, being clothed in a purple robe, all show Jesus as the archaic sacrificial king. This time, it is the sacrifice of the Son to the Father. See the complete reversal from the previous rituals. Or, in Jungian terms, of the ego to the self, with capital S.
That was from a talk given to the C.G. Jung Society of Melbourne by Maureen Buckley-Fox. And welcome to the Society's podcast, I'm Ariel Moy. The Jung Society offers a space for the exploration and development of Jungian ideas and practice. We offer talks on the third Friday evening of every month, as well as courses and workshops, a Jungian library, a newsletter and discussion groups. Please visit our website at jungsocietymelbourne.com or our Facebook page. Before launching into today's talk, I have an announcement. It's with sadness that today's podcast will be the last for now, as my working life has become too busy to continue. It has been an absolute pleasure to produce these episodes over the last few years, and the reception has been wonderful, with almost 38,000 downloads across 68 countries. So I'm sending out a special request. If anyone might find themselves with time and inclination, please contact the Melbourne Jung Society at contact@jungsocietymelbourne.com or visit our website. The only experience required is a willingness to learn how to use the technology and a passion for all matters Jungian. It would be lovely to see the podcast continue on. Maureen Buckley-Fox is a transpersonal counsellor and writer. She has 25 years of teaching experience, focusing on literature and classical studies, and facilitates workshops on classical mythology and women's studies. With a focus on the big questions of the human condition, fertility, cycles of birth and death, destiny and free will, suffering and the life journey, Maureen weaves her way through ancient rituals in honour of the Earth Mother and goddesses with many names. She leads us to Dionysus, incorporating both the masculine and the matriarchal in ritual worship, through to the rise of patriarchal society and a focus on the individual man. We look at the ritual of drama as it first emerged on the stage with the Greek tragedians, and note how the sacred mysteries and questions were incorporated into these plays. The significance of ritual in attending to and supporting our inner struggles towards selfhood is captured in her discussion of Jung's essay, Transformation Symbolism in the Mass. We hope you enjoy. Please note Maureen does refer to a number of images in the talk. Examples of these or similar can be found on the internet.
Thank you, everyone, for your welcome. Tonight, I'm going to discuss four different aspects of sacred drama. Firstly, a look at the quote, I like that, all the world's a stage and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts, his acts being seven ages. I think that's a good quote to keep in mind, especially since I'm standing up here at the moment. I'm just playing one of my many parts. The first thing I'll be looking at are the ancient rituals performed by women in honour of the Earth Mother in matrifocal and agrarian eras. I say matrifocal or matriarchal, same thing. Secondly, the beginnings of drama on the stage as it evolved from harvest festivals to a celebration of the god Dionysus. And then a brief look at some of the plays of Aeschylus, Sophocles and Euripides from 5th century BC in Periclean Athens. And lastly, a short discussion on Jung's essay, The Transformation Symbolism of the Mass. Jung states that the most important mystery of the Catholic Church rests, among other things, on psychic conditions which are deeply rooted in the human soul. I've got a few quotes sprinkled around from the essay by Jung. He says that today, rites and dogmas are seen as merely external factors and not experienced as inner events. And to Jung, the Mass is the rite of the individuation process, and it has its origins in ancient pagan rituals, which is really quite fascinating. So in the past, all activity was endowed with spirituality. Everything was, people were aware in ancient cultures of the spirit, the spiritual life, the spiritual being. Working the land, preparing the food, making love. The modern world has made a separation of these elements. Ritual existed long before the word, language, intellect and logic. And in ancient times, drama and sacred worship were inextricably linked and acted out in ritual. In the matrifocal agrarian age, the great Earth Mother was worshipped in her many forms, and women participated in the reenactment of her sacred mysteries, quite a lot of different mysteries. One such mystery was the descent to the underworld. And I'm going to have a little look at Inanna firstly, so you'll be hearing a few myths tonight. Surprise. Inanna, or Ishtar, as she was called in northern Sumeria, and Inanna in Sumer. Ishtar, same goddess, same earth mother. Ishtar in Babylon, Astarte was her name in Syria, and Isis in Egypt. And if you look at her beautiful shape, she's not a Kate Moss. People worshipped women for their bodies because they saw them as the life givers. They had the children. And Marie Gimbutas is a good source if you want to do some research in that area of ancient goddess and the earth mothers. I'll refer to her as Inanna tonight. She's one of the three great goddesses of the Bronze Age. She's the great mother. And a quote, clothed with heavens and crowned with the stars. She wears the rainbow as her necklace and the zodiac as her girdle. She is virgin queen of heaven and earth. And the story of Inanna was recorded on cuneiform tablets, the oldest known form of writing in 2000 BC. I'll just give you one story about Inanna. There are many variations on every myth, as most of you know. Tammuz, or sometimes referred to as Dumuzi, is her son lover. He'd been mortally wounded by a wild boar, and Inanna decides to go down to the underworld to awaken him. That's what she says she's going to do. But on the way, she decides to visit her sister Eriskigal on the pretense of rescuing her son lover husband. But her intention is actually to take rulership of heaven and earth. Eriskigal is aware of this, and as Inanna descends, dressed in all her finery, Eriskigal has instructed her servants to close the doors firmly behind her sister so she is trapped. Good example of sisterly love. At each of the seven gates, Inanna Ishtar is stripped of one piece of her clothing, it'll be the necklaces, and then bit by bit at each of the seven places, until she is completely naked. Eriskigal then kills her sister and hangs her corpse on a stake. Inanna is eventually resurrected by the other gods, but she has to choose a replacement for herself. So she leaves Tammuz, her husband, in the underworld, and she goes back to Earth. Inanna was worshipped through sacred rituals. This is just one of them. One such ritual was a fast of lamentation, representing her mourning for her husband. She left him there, but she mourned for him. This fast was focused on the idea of resurrection. Many early rituals in these times involved several days of ceremonies, not just the 1 hour or 2 hours that we might do. And they culminated often in a sacred marriage between the high priestess and the king. In the sacred marriage of ancient times, a high priestess chose a king, often a son lover, only for 1 year. And with the full knowledge, they all knew that he would be killed at the end of that year and returned to Mother Earth buried. This might sound barbaric to us, but everyone then believed in reincarnation. So it seemed to them it was just a matter of he has a great time for a year and then he's buried, but he'll be born again. But the ritual slaying of the king was in order to promote the fertility of the land. They really believed that would increase fertility and they would have good crops and the prosperity of the people. So that's an example, you could say, of a winning sacrifice. So just in summary, brief summary, 4,000 years ago, we have a written record of a myth of a descent to the underworld and resurrection after immense suffering, but all involving around women's rituals, a reenactment of the death-rebirth theme. However, the central heroic figure is a female, Inanna. During this era, goddess worship prevailed and the earth was worshipped as mother. Seeds were planted in her womb and crops grew to feed the people, and the corn goddesses were honoured. Women's bodies were revered as vessels which gave birth to the child. So I put some of the information on the slides because the names are quite unusual, Tammuz and Erishkigal, etc. But perhaps the most famous festival, these are some of the rituals, the Panathenaic procession in honour of Athena, the rites of Artemis at Boron, I'll mention briefly, the Thesmophoria, which was a fertility rite for Demeter, and a brief mention of the Demeter and Persephone myth, which most of you, or a lot of you, might be familiar with. But perhaps the most famous festival restricted to women was the Thesmophoria, a fertility rite for Demeter. Ceres, the Romans called her Ceres, and she's a corn goddess. Our word cereal, breakfast cereal, comes from Ceres. Anyway, the purpose of this ritual is, to promote the fertility of the fields, and it also involves a descent to the underworld. Demeter mourns for her daughter Persephone, who has been abducted by Hades, Greek god of the underworld. And as a result of her deep suffering, crops fail, men and women are no longer coupling, and there is famine. Again, the women spent 3 days living in Demeter's hilltop sanctuary. And a late Roman source about 2nd century described the ritual, because it's very hard to find information, as you can imagine, about secret women's rituals, because they were secret and was only women and initiates who participated in the main parts of the ceremonies. But during this ritual, women known as balers stayed pure for 3 days, fasting and prayer, and then they descend into secret chambers. Again, you have this descent into the earth, the underground, or the symbolically the underworld. And they bring up rotten remains of objects that have been thrown into the pits, and then they place these objects on altars. The rotten remains that they have been thrown down there for some time consist of replicas of snakes and male genitals made from dough. Pigs are also believed to have been in the pits, because in the myth about with Demeter and Persephone, Persephone is abducted by Hades and taken to the underworld. There is another myth that says that a swineherd was there at the time, and he and his pigs were swallowed up into the underworld. So pigs, again, are very much associated with the mother goddess and represent fertility. So anyone who scatters these rotten remains from the pit on the earth is believed to have good crops. And they also say there are serpents down in the chasm, so the celebrants clap and shout when the women are baling these objects out to make the serpents go away. And the pigs associated with female genitalia help to promote fertility. Again, so it's all about crops and fertility and fertility of women at this stage, ancient matrifocal era. During the Thesmophoria, the women camped out on the hillside, mimicking the mourning of Demeter for her lost daughter, and finally celebrated a feast in honour of birth. Demeter and Ceres were the goddesses of fertility. And I sort of look at this, because we're looking at bread and wine, the symbolism of bread and wine throughout the talk, as the focus is on corn and, we could say, bread in a way, and women and fertility. So there's a little bit there that I've just read to you about the Thesmophoria, and that's how you spell it. That's actually a sculpture by Bernini of Persephone being abducted by Hades. An absolutely stunning piece of sculpture. Another myth that I like that centres on women, or really love, is the rites of Artemis, the goddess Artemis, who was the huntress, and they were conducted at Boron, which is quite a fair way from Athens. Girls of different ages and class before the age of puberty participated in races in honour of Artemis at a sanctuary at Boron, and the ritual was known as the Archetyre. It was playing the she-bear. The little girls would dress up as little bears and they would play and engage in races, and it was all run naked or have short tunics, and it was all sort of celebration of the goddess Artemis, the huntress, and the goddess of animals. So a way, again, of worshipping the goddess and honouring the goddess. Sacrifice, thanksgiving, awe, again, that sense of reverence for higher powers, are common threads throughout these sacred reenactments. Scholars, actually, there's a lot of theories about the rise of the patriarchy, but some of them say that the women's secret and sacred ritual centred around the knowledge that the women knew that they needed the men for conception, but the men didn't realise that they were actually playing a part, a role in procreation right back in this period. Once they found out, things changed, of course. And it was probably suggested again by some scholars that it was the time of the invasion of the Indo-European horsemen, who appeared with detailed biological knowledge of the facts of life and told the people that the men were played a significant role in conception. Anyway, this is sort of one reason for the beginning of the rise of patriarchy. The early ancient festivals were performed on a circular threshing floor, just a round floor, and people, you know, about 50, 60 people, would celebrate the coming of spring after long winters, that, for example, an image of the death-rebirth motif. They had also pagan rites associated with the gathering of the harvest continued right into Christian times. The Feast of Corpus Christi in the church is one of them, and Thanksgiving in America is another one. Song and dance was a major part of this celebration in the harvest festivals, a lot of excitement, a lot of noise. The participants wore masks and animal masks quite often, and I've seen reenactments of them on video, and the men often strapped these huge erect phalluses and danced around with those as well. So again, with the rise of the patriarchy, they start to forget about the womb and the woman's body, and the phallus becomes very prominent, important. I move now to... Oh, that's a picture of Dionysus, by the way, who will be talking a bit about Dionysus. He's the god of wine, ecstasy and drama, and that would be about 5th century BC, a vase painting of that time. So you see him with the laurel leaves, and he looks pretty pretty happy. So there's a little bit about Dionysus, and I'll speak about two of the myths about his birth. Again, we have a variety of myths for every god and goddess. But we'll move to Pericles in Athens in 5th century BC. So we've sort of talked a little bit about the ancient rituals of the matrifocal era, and then the harvest festivals. But it all really happened in 5th century BC in Athens, the time of Pericles. It's very much a patriarchal world now. The Earth Mother goddesses have been deposed. And it's interesting how the myths in that period of time changed, where the focus goes completely away from the women who and the birth-giving, their wonderful bodies to give birth. And these gods and goddesses start to have stories of their birth, and they're born from men. I'll give you a couple of examples. Zeus at this stage is the king of the Greek gods, and Metis, he's a great seducer, okay? So Metis is a goddess, powerful goddess of wisdom, and she becomes pregnant with Zeus's child. He swallows her. Don't ask me why. There's a lot of weird and wonderful stories in myth. He gives birth to the child that she had, and that's Athena. And some of you might know the story of the birth of Athena from the head of Zeus. All right, that's one example. So myths start to denigrate the role of the woman who nurtures the child in her womb and gives birth. Dionysus is another one. He's the twice-born. The second birth is from Zeus's thigh. They're quite odd. Many of you familiar with myths at all? Yeah, a lot of you would be, know these. Yes, Aphrodite, of course, is born from the foaming sea. So just getting back to Pericles in Athens, the mind, intellect and rationality rule. Great philosophical debates, era of great, wonderful time. I'd love to have lived in that time myself. But the poor old women, in Athens anyway, not in Sparta, but they're locked inside their homes. They're virtually prisoners in their own homes at this stage. Their only outlet is to attend women's festivals in honour of the goddesses, usually at this stage Athena, Aphrodite and Artemis, and they have to be accompanied. However, at this time, this new god Dionysus is assuming importance, and no one really knows how, when, where, or why, but Dionysus suddenly is added to the Greek pantheon of major gods and goddesses. He is the god of wine, ecstasy, and drama, and the women now begin to go to the hills and participate in wild, wild rituals, where they chase animals. Well, this is one part of it. They take, they get high on whatever's around, I imagine, and they chase the animal, tear the animal to pieces, and eat the animal's raw flesh. So it's a wild party. But eating the raw flesh of the animal was symbolically eating the flesh of the god Dionysus, because they saw the animal as a representation of Dionysus, who was born from the thigh of Zeus. Dionysus is also, he's very much an androgynous god. He has both masculine and feminine qualities. So just have a couple of myths again, or several, about Dionysus. And one of them, this is a later painting, of course, he looks like a cute little boy in this one. But the first story briefly I'll tell you about his birth. Zeus mated with Persephone's mother, and then later with Persephone herself, which is his own daughter. He changed himself into a serpent in order to do this. The Titans attacked the boy child Dionysus, tore him into seven pieces. A seven, of course, is symbolic number, and threw these into a cauldron which was standing on a tripod. When the flesh was boiled, they began roasting it over a fire on seven spits. Zeus intervenes, because it's his son, hurls the Titans back into Tartarus, which is the Greek word for hell, and gives the child's limbs to the god Apollo. So another version says Demeter saves the child god her own and restores him to life. But here, again, the purpose of telling you this, we've got the themes of death and rebirth, dismemberment, and resurrection. A more popular myth of the child god Dionysus is the one I'll tell you now. His mother, Semele, who's a mortal woman, again, Zeus, very busy god, seduces her. And Zeus's wife, or wife slash sister, Hera, is sick of her husband's infidelities, and she was always trying to cause trouble. When she finds out Semele, a mere mortal woman, is pregnant to Zeus, she tricks Semele into asking Zeus to allow her to see Zeus in all his majesty. But Zeus, of course, is such a brilliantly powerful, majestic god that anyone who looks at him will virtually be incinerated. And Hera knows this. So Semele is pregnant, and she asks Zeus if she can see him in his majesty, and he says yes, but she's incinerated. But somehow before that happens, he takes the child, which is Dionysus, and wraps him in his thigh, as I mentioned before, and then the child is born from Zeus's thigh. So the boy child Dionysus becomes known as the twice-born. And again, we've got the death rebirth theme. But as he was growing, as Dionysus is growing up, Cybele or Rhea taught him her religious rites, and this is where the wine comes into it. She teaches him how to grow, cultivate vines and produce wine and extract the juice. So it's interesting that some later scholars drew parallels between Christ and Dionysus in Christian theology. And I've put up a picture here of Christ and the cross, but all the grapes around and the sense of the association with the wine and the vine. In early Christian art as well, many of the churches had the pillars and the ceilings decked with the symbols of vines and grapes, as I said, in Christian churches. There's one more. This is actually a church, a little chapel in a church, St. Barbara. Can you see that clearly enough? It's the Christ there and the vines, the saints sort of within the vine. So interesting parallels have been made between that. So this is continuation of the Christian theology being connected with the ancient pagan gods, goddesses and rites. Another scholar argues that the New Testament story of Jesus changing water into wine at the marriage feast of Cana is to show the superiority of Jesus over Dionysus. So Dionysus could produce wine, but Jesus could change water into wine. Just some interesting things, connections. In the play by Euripides, the women called the Maenads, again, they go into the hills for several days and engage in rituals which include chasing the animal, tearing it to pieces and eating the raw flesh. It's an unholy communion in a way, but as I said, they had such a bad life being locked up in their houses. I think they must have gone crazy when they had a chance to get out. So Dionysus becomes an important deity for women in classical Athens, and vase paintings and literary passages generally suggest that Dionysian rites, it was a release from ordinary life. So women's rituals continued, but the emphasis moved then to harvest celebrations. Men and women participated, as I said before, they danced and sang on the circular threshing floor, and there could have been 50, there could have been 100 people all engaging in these activities. But the idea was to give thanks to the gods for successful harvest. So we have the celebration, the Thanksgiving themes again. Then legend has it that one man, this is legend, stepped out from the chorus, this group of people who are singing and dancing, having a wonderful time, and talked to the audience, to the other people. And his name was Thespis. Hence, actors are often called thespians. So women continue to worship the goddesses at their temples, but they also turned their attention to this new god, Dionysus. And this is where we move into sort of the actual plays that were performed in Athens in the 5th century. But because it's a great time, you know, philosophy, discussion, who is man? Why does man die? Why is man subject to death? What is man's relationship to the gods? All these things were new in 5th century BC because before, in the homeless time, people did believe in the gods and goddesses. If someone fell in love, it was a great excuse if he had an affair because it was Aphrodite's fault. If you went to war or you punched someone or killed someone, oh, it wasn't me, it was Ares was sitting on my shoulder. The god of war made me do it. So it's a new focus on the individual responsibility and the position of man in the world. So just a little bit about that's actually a stage. And as it says there, I'm going to have a drink of water. It's photographed from the Acropolis, the theatre of Dionysus. There are not any of the original theatres from 5th century BC because they were wooden and they would have been destroyed for many years. But they've built stone ones in the same sort of format that the original wooden ones were. So before the plays started, it was a wonderful festival. Playwrights competed for prizes in a week-long festival known as the City Dionysia, and it took place always towards the end of March. 2 days before it began, the citizens of Athens made their way at dawn to the Temple of Dionysus on the lower slopes of the Acropolis. A statue of Dionysus was lifted and placed in a cart to be taken in procession to a shrine in the outlying village. And at dusk, the statue was returned by torchlights. It must have been a wonderful time. You know, everyone looked forward to this week-long celebration. When they returned to the temple of the god, they carried his statue a short way up the hill into the theatre named after him. Then Dionysus was considered to be present in the theatre. The statue was there and they'd put him into the theatre. Prisoners were released on bail to take part in the procession. Again, huge phalluses were carried to symbolise the god's gift of fertility, and a bull was led along the road for sacrifice. It's easier to get information in 5th century BC because there's a lot of written sources. Before that, you're scrambling around trying to find information. and a lot of it is theory. So again, notice the movement from the metrofocal ear. I keep saying this, but trying to get a bit of sort of connection. Where the womb and the earth was honoured, to the patriarchal era, where phallic objects became the focus of attention, and the Dionysus as a new god and the focus too on wine. At sunrise, the people crowded the theatre precinct, and again, this was a celebration of the offspring and death and rebirth, a celebration of the mysteries of men and gods. And as I said, one of the focal questions was, who and what is man? The definition of drama, because we're moving into the three major playwrights of tragedy anyway, Aeschylus, Sophocles and Euripides, 5th century BC in Athens. Definition of drama, it uses actors, takes place in something like a theatre, an area defined by an audience, probably has a plot and, more importantly, an inner form. Mystery surrounds the origin of theatre. Again, Peter Brook states that drama is an act of communion when a number of people are gathered together through the intense involvement in an action stemming out of life. But there is a change of state, hence that god, the god Dionysus being associated with drama, a sense of, as an actor putting on a mask, being out of yourself, not being yourself. Transformation, catharsis, and a transformation of the personality. So the Greeks knew about the legends of and the myths of Homer, and a lot of that material was used in the plays that they wrote. But at the same time in 5th century BC in Athens, one of the new philosophers, Protagoras, he came up with the idea that man is the measure of all things. That's why a famous quote of that time, man is the measure of all things, in complete contrast, of course, to the theories that the gods and the goddesses were responsible for everything in man's life. So what some of the things that were discussed on stage or offered to audiences, what is man's relationship to the gods? Does man have free will, or is he at the mercy of fate? Are the sins of the fathers visited on their sons, or not just fathers and sons, but mothers and daughters, the generations? These questions and many more were posed to audiences in these plays, and Aeschylus, Sophocles and Euripides really became the voices of the people. Now, also a very important aspect of Greek drama are the masks that they wore. That's one such example. And this is another slide here, taken from a Greek vase again. Hercules and Dionysus holding masks. So I have a quick look at, as I mentioned, there's Aeschylus, Sophocles, Euripides. Aristophanes wrote the comedies. And I'm only going to look at one play, about one play from each of them. So Aeschylus, according to Aristotle, remember I said that originally he had the chorus, the harvest festivals, lots of people dancing and singing, and then one person stepped out to address the audience, Thespis. Well, Aeschylus decided he would introduce a second actor, and that was radical, two people engaging in dialogue. So that's what they see as the beginning of drama. And he reduced them, he still maintained, he kept a chorus, but he reduced the number to 12. The chorus performed several really important functions. They provided the audience with information about the mythological background to the plays, and even though the audience pretty well knew most of the myths, they needed reminding about particular ones that were relevant to the action of the play that was on the stage. They also commented on the actions of the protagonists in the plays, and that could include warnings to beware of committing the sin of hubris. Now, and of course, hubris was pride, an act of pride. But in particular, hubris was if men considering themselves to be equal to or better than the gods. That was their idea of hubris. So Aeschylus wrote 90 plays, but only 7 survive. And one of the famous plays, or the 3 plays actually, the Aristaean trilogy, it poses one of the questions of the sins being of the fathers being visited on their sons, the curse of generations. Audiences wouldn't have known about the curse of the house of Atreus, but there's another. If you get into myths, there's a myth before a myth before a myth, and I haven't, obviously, I'm not going to go off on those tangents. But there's one that's quite interesting. Tantalus was a mortal man, and he was invited to go and sup or have dinner with the gods. And for some reason, Tantalus boils the body of his son Pelops to serve it up to the gods at dinner. And nice stuff. Again, it's this eating of the flesh that comes in, these recurrent themes all the time. Anyway, the gods realise that they've been tricked and they decide to punish Tantalus. They're really angry with him. So they send him to Hades, to hell, to suffer eternal punishment. And his punishment is to stand in eternity in a pool of water. And every time he's surrounded by water and he's surrounded by wonderful trees covered with figs and fruit, every time Tantalus stoops to take a drink of water or to take a fig or something to eat, well, the water recedes and he's thirsty, he can never have anything to drink, and the wind blows the branches away, so he can never actually get anything to eat. Good punishment. That's only one of the punishments in Tantalus, in Hades. Some of them are much more horrific than that. But again, our word tantalize comes from that myth, you might know. But the descendants of, this is relevant to the play, because the descendants of Tantalus are Thyestes and Atreus, and they're two brothers who vie for power and quarrel about, they both want to be the king of Argos forever, so they fight and they argue. But this is a good story. Thyestes seduces his brother's wife, and in return, his brother Atreus murders his brother's sons and serves him to him at a banquet. You have to ask yourself why you keep getting this, you know, eating. First, it's human sacrifice and it's animal sacrifice, but these myths that have the eating of the flesh, it's interesting. So you think that Atreus has got away with the murder, but again, there are debts to pay because the house then is cursed, or future generations going to be cursed for a long time. So the play Agamemnon by Aeschylus is about Agamemnon, who is one of the descendants of the house of Atreus. He goes off to the Trojan War and fights for the Greeks for 10 years. He's the general, as you probably know. Before he goes to the war, he sacrifices his daughter Iphigenia because he needs the winds for the boats to sail to go to Troy. Nice father. But then 10 years of fighting in the Trojan War, Agamemnon returns home. And in the meantime, his wife Clytemnestra is not too happy. He's been away for 10 years. He sacrificed their daughter, tricked her into allowing her to be sacrificed. So she sort of waits till the husband comes home after 10 years. In the meantime, she has a lover, by the way, Aegisthus. And when he comes in home, she greets him and she gets an axe and kills him. I shouldn't laugh, should I? Agamemnon also brings home the spoils of war, lots of gold and everything, but Cassandra as well. If you've heard of Cassandra, she was betrothed to marry Apollo, and then as a wedding present, he gave her the gift of prophecy, but then she decided she wanted to remain a virgin. So Apollo couldn't take back the gift of prophecy, but he put a curse on her that no one would ever believe her. She would see what was going to happen, but no one would believe her. So poor old Cassandra gets hauled back from Troy, where she was a princess, as a concubine for Agamemnon. And she is killed as well, Clytemnestra, after she finishes Agamemnon off, takes the axe to Cassandra. But before she is killed, because she's seen the blood on the wall, she knows what's going to happen, she screams out, "This is a house that hates the gods." She's aware of this, again, this curse. So in this play, there's a constant cycle of crime and punishment and acts of revenge. And the message is clear: man must not offend the gods. Because a lot of people, philosophers, were saying, no such thing as the gods, it's all up to man. Man is the measure of all things. But this play is saying no. Not so. So the other themes: rivalry between the father and the son, desire for rulership and power, and the father unwittingly eating the flesh of the son. Have I got time for some earlier myths? It's a consistent theme, this eating and the father, rivalry of the father and the son. In very early creation myths in Greek mythology, Uranus is married, or not married, but his partner is Gaia, Mother Earth, and he's the sky god. And every time Gaia gives birth, he hates them. He says they're so ugly, he hides them in a cave. So then his son, Kronos, grows up, gets out of the cave and, spurred on by his mother, takes revenge. And the revenge is to cut off his father's genitals and throw them into the sea. And that's how Aphrodite is born, from the foaming sea of his private parts. Then Kronos swallows his children when his partner gives birth. But Zeus is saved. There's one child who is saved. And he grows up to overthrow his father, and that's how Zeus becomes king and ruler of the gods of Olympus. But one little comparison to say we've hopefully evolved somewhat. In the Christian Mass, the symbolism, etc., in the story of Jesus, the son is offered to the father as a willing sacrifice. So just this relationship, that's why I'm mentioning them, between the son and the father and the fight for power. Now, moving on. Oh, that's taken from a bowl, and if you can see, it's Clytemnestra with the axe. So, Sophocles. Sophocles' major play is Oedipus the King. Do most of you know Oedipus the King? So his major themes were about the human condition, but man's apparent inability to escape his fate. Because just to fill you in briefly, but most of you all know, Oedipus, when he was born, there was a prophecy that he would, if he lived, he would kill his father and marry his mother and live in an incestuous relationship. And anyway, he tried to avoid his fate. But Sophocles, he introduced a third actor. So at this stage, the evolution of drama, you've now got three people on the stage wearing masks and engaging in dialogue. And the chorus, he increased to 15. So he had a chorus of 15 people commenting. He was a favourite of the people, Sophocles. And when Oedipus discovers, when he's older, by this time he's had four children with his wife Eucasta, and when he discovers that he actually has killed his father and married his mother, he blinds himself and goes into exile. I haven't got time to tell you all of the details of the play, but it's really worth reading if you're interested. I imagine the majority of you have read it, am I right? No? Anyway, just a quote from Freudian. There's been a lot of work of Freudians on this about incestuous desires of the son to the mother. But I quite liked from a book by Dr. Jeremy Taylor, The Living Labyrinth, what he said. Freudian metaphors aside, the Oedipus story also gives symbolic shape to the inevitable struggle over the equally inevitable transfer of power from one generation to the next, and the endless battle of the younger generation of male leaders to succeed the older generation of patriarchs before the older men are prepared to relinquish power. So it's power battle again. Another play that Sophocles wrote, it's called Antigone, and Antigone was one of the daughters from the incestuous relationship with his mother. Sophocles, in this particular play, he writes what is referred to as an ode on man, and it's a beautiful piece of poetry. And man is praised for all his wonderful achievements, fishing in the seas, killing animals and providing food, building, curing diseases, because democracy was introduced in this time as well, you know, having civilizations, rulership and governorship, all these wonderful things, the flourishing of discussion. However, the final words of this ode are a warning, or another question. Man cannot conquer death. To live fully and humanly, in Sophocles' view, is to know fully the conditions of man's existence. I don't know how you can know fully, but this, anyway, in his view, it was to accept the gods. All the time he's warning people in the play, you cannot escape your fate. The more Sophocles, Oedipus tries to run away from his destiny, the more he just moves straight into it. The thing is, with this play, though, with Oedipus, he's the archetypal tragic hero, but he ends up, when he finds out what he's done, he blinds himself. And in that way, he goes into voluntary exile. He never returns to his home. He says no one should look at him again. He's so ashamed. So he is a man who is ennobled by his suffering. So again, that theme of suffering coming in. And the words of the chorus and the end of, in this play, nothing of magnitude comes into the life of mortals without suffering and disaster. I'm sure you all wanted to hear that. So, Euripides, and he was the least popular of the three writers of tragedy. His masterpiece, The Bacchae, wasn't performed until after his death. He didn't win any prizes at the festivals, the others did. But The Bacchae was awarded a posthumous prize. Euripides was sceptical of established beliefs and values in the gods. He reduced the role of the chorus drastically, so his plays are much easier to read. And he introduced a prologue, often between two gods or two goddesses or a god and a goddess before the play starts. But in The Bacchae, Euripides sees the god, Dionysus is a chief character in this play. He sees the gods, or Dionysus, as an overwhelming force against which there is no resistance. He was like a psychologist, 5th century BC, first psychologist, really interested in why, you know, the psychology of men's minds. In the play, Dionysus, the god, is portrayed as androgynous, containing the duality of masculine and feminine traits in perfect balance. And King Pentheus mocks Dionysus, and that's not a nice thing to do. So King Pentheus ends up paying a huge price for that, his death, without going into the other details. In this play, there is no hero. We have the tragic hero in Oedipus, the king. The final message seems to be, because Euripides is quite difficult to understand, a lot of people say he is a misogynist, and yet in some of his plays you read the speeches of the women, and he really gives women a voice. For instance, Medea, who kills her two children in revenge for Jason's infidelity, she says, she has a long speech in his play, and she says, "I would rather stand in the front line of battle three times than bear one child." So, and in other plays too, Euripides was definitely not a misogynist, but he did create some pretty monstrous female characters. So he's a riddle in himself, or his plays are a bit of a riddle. Euripides gave form to the dilemma faced by the men of the time, the struggle of the man of conscious intellect to acknowledge forces beyond his control and rational understanding. I think it's always true, isn't it? Tragedy was a means to contain and express the paradoxes of life, probably one way of putting it. So now I've briefly discussed ancient Greek drama, which was acted out on the stage, dealing with universal issues such as man's relationship with the gods. There are many more, but obviously I've got limitations with time. So man's relationship with the gods, death, rebirth, fate and destiny versus man's free will is in Oedipus. Family curses, the sins of the fathers, etc. Suffering, and the journey through life, the hero's journey, in particular the journey of the tragic hero. So I'm going to look now turn to a different stage for the reenactment of ancient mysteries in a different form. And the mass. Jung describes the mass, as I said before, as the rite of the individuation process, and the mass, I'm taking these quotes from his essay, The Transformation Symbolism of the Mass. The mass contains the steps in ritual of man's journey to the self. To the view of the church, the mass is based on the historical events in Jesus' life. The scourging, crowning with thorns, being clothed in a purple robe, all show Jesus as the archaic sacrificial king. This time, it is the sacrifice of the Son to the Father. See the complete reversal from the previous rituals. Or, in Jungian terms, of the ego to the self, with capital S. The priest acts as intermediary in offering the bread and the wine, but the bread from the matrifocal era, the wine from the Dionysian era, So they come together. The audience is the congregation assembled in the church on a different stage. The gifts are offered to Christ, the man God, who suffered, descended into the underworld, was resurrected in 3 days. And in the ritual of the Mass, in Jung's words, invisible, unseen forces are at work. So he's getting the mystery there that we just can't understand. They've tried through centuries to make sense, 5th century BC, make sense of what man is about and what life is about. They're still asking the same questions. But he says, yeah, invisible, unseen forces are at work. Time and space are transcended in the moment of the consecration. He says you can't understand the mystery of it. The priest, I'll just give you a couple of, because some of you obviously aren't familiar with the rites of the Mass, so just a couple of things. The priest, the celebrant, offers the host to the Son in the name of the Father, so the Father, Son, but quite different. Ritual actions and the text of the Mass relate to the transformation process. The priest is a servant of grace. The Mass stands for something otherworldly and beyond our power to comprehend. Just one example with the offertory. Before placing the bread on the altar, the priest says, "Blessed are you, Lord, God of all creation. Through your goodness we have this bread to offer, which earth has given and human hands have made. It will become for us the bread of life." Connection with the bread. When he pours wine and a little water into the chalice, he says, "By the mystery of this water and wine, may we come to share in the divinity of Christ, who humbled himself to share in our humanity. Blessed are you, Lord, God of all creation. Through your goodness we have this wine to offer, fruit of the vine and work of human hands. It will become our spiritual drink." With the offering of the bread, we are reminded of the ancient matrifocal rituals with the focus on the corn goddess and the Mother Earth. The wine reminds us of Dionysus. So you have the masculine wine, feminine bread, symbolising the androgynous nature of the mystical Christ. Jesus is sacrificed for the good of humanity. And according to Jung, our moralistic view of suffering as punishment is inadequate. Suffering leads to transformation. And the path to self-knowledge is a painful one. In the same way, and that we're told that very often in the 5th century BC, life involves suffering. In the same way, every step along the path to individuation is achieved only at the cost of suffering, reclaiming a shadow or growing or whatever, Jungian thought on that. And according to Jung, the most important mystery of the Catholic Church rests, among other things, on psychic conditions which are deeply rooted in the human soul, mysteries that we just can't comprehend. The symbols aim at wholeness, and in coming to terms with them, we re-establish the lost connection with ideas and feelings that make a synthesis of the personality possible. Jesus is the sacrificial, archaic king who must be sacrificed. The archaic king in mythology had to be killed in order to promote the fertility of the land and the prosperity of his people. Just as Jesus Christ is sacrificed for the salvation of mankind. Suffering and sacrifice are part of our human existence, and not one of us can escape death. Christ is the archetypal tragic hero. The difference is that Christ willingly embraces death and suffering to transform humanity. In Jungian terminology, we say the sacrifice of the ego to the self, capital S. The problem today is, you might agree with me, free not to, we have lost our ability to immerse ourselves in the mysteries, to suspend disbelief and enter into one of the greatest mysteries of all, or even get that sense of awe and reverence and mystery and beauty of the world. The ego must submit to the higher self. Must. This involves dismemberment of the ego, which involves suffering. In ancient times, the participants in ritual believed in gods and goddesses. They gave thanks, made sacrifices, and celebrated, as we have seen. Today, as Jung said, logic and reason prevail in a secular world, and rites and dogmas are seen as external factors and not experienced as inner events. We have forgotten how to immerse ourselves in mystery. So I will leave you with the mystery of the mystery. But I just had one quote from Teilhard de Chardin, which I really like. He said, he wrote a lot about the cosmic mass, and he was a mystic and had the experiences. And he said, at the end, we will have a true cosmic mass. The entire cosmos is a living host. And I couldn't resist another poet. We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed Maureen's epic journey through ancient ritual and drama as a part of everyday life and meaning making. She draws on Jung's essay about the Catholic Mass to lead us to the power of ritual in acknowledging suffering and the unknown. With Jung's understanding that the ego must submit to the self, and in doing so, suffer, Maureen invites us to consider how ritual matters, and the ways that dreams, myths, and religious rites can support our individuation. Thank you for listening, and please visit us at www.jungsocietymelbourne.com or have a look at our Facebook page.